Dear Colgate, I love that you love that I love being at home. You even let me whiten my teeth from home.
Because you know how I feel about getting up from my cloud couch.
The Colgate Optic White LED Kit gives professional level results in just 10 minutes a day for 10 days when used as directed.
And that's why, Colgate, I want you to meet my parents.
Because ever since meeting you, I've been living life to the brightest.
Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
At Delta, we know Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. On the next flight, 8C is Mandy, a foodie. So we offer all types of food options. Because at Delta, everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. By Israeli law, international law, and agreement over the so-called roadmap for Mideast peace, Israel is not supposed to expand outposts and settlements in the Palestinian territory of the West Bank. A major new report commissioned by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says that illicit government policy in Israel makes a mockery of those laws and agreements, that Israeli ministries have systematically established illegal settlements, that, in its words, blatant violations of the law have become institutional. The charges go to the heart of Israel's unresolved and dangerous internal struggle over land and peace between determined believers in an Israeli right to more of the Holy Land and Israeli law and commitments that say no. Tonight on Point, the fight inside Israel. We begin tonight in Israel. Molly Moore is Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked her to explain exactly what this new study conducted by Israeli former chief prosecutor Talia Sasson is saying.
This report is saying what a lot of people already knew, but what is so significant is that it's the government saying it, and an investigator within the government saying that Israeli ministries have been illegally funding and constructing settlement outposts as well as seizing private Palestinian land to build some of them.
And that is big news to have a government report saying that. Why?
Well, most of the time, the ministries attempt to deny this when they're charged with it, although in the past, there have been some other isolated government reports that have talked about, several millions of dollars being used. This report goes much further. This is a report of over 300 pages with another 200 pages of maps that cites very specific incidents, cites the housing ministry, the defense ministry, the World Zionist Organization, everyone or a large number of the agencies that are actually involved in expanding settlements and outposts in violation of Israeli law and, of course, in violation of UN resolutions and other international mandates.
Molly, take us through the laws that this breaks and the agreements that it breaks. First of all, at the Israeli law level, exactly what's being violated here?
Well, under the Israeli law, settlements should not be expanded out beyond their established borders. Now, of course, the United Nations and other international agencies say settlements should not be expanded, period. But what is so significant here is that outposts, the vast majority of them, are clear violations of laws on every level. And what is really significant about this at this point in time is there's a lot of concern in Israel that one of the things that's going on with the disengagement from Gaza is that it's detracting attention from the rapidly escalating settlement growth throughout the West Bank. And what outposts are simply hilltop settings where the settlers and these Israeli government agencies have brought in trailers and families move into them, and usually they're very strategically located so that they can connect settlements once neighborhoods expand. One that I have been watching expanded in about 2.5 years' time from a cellular telephone tower on a hilltop to more than 180 residents, a synagogue, a nursery school, a playground, a full community in only 2.5 years. And it's a completely illegal outpost.
How do these outposts figure into the so-called roadmap for peace? Is there also some breaking of Israeli agreements? Are the Israelis not fulfilling their assurances to Washington?
Well, this is one of the big issues in terms of the Palestinians and the Americans. The Palestinians say precisely this. This is according to the Palestinian view, one of the most egregious things that Israel is doing in not abiding by the roadmap, which says all settlement expansion should stop. This is one area where the U.S. in the past has criticized Israel, but has not really done anything to stop them from doing it.
Why did Mr. Sharon commission this study? He must have known that it could or would come out very critical.
Well, there's several theories on this. He obviously knew it would come out very critical. It's hard to believe that he didn't know what these ministries and agencies were doing, because, in fact, Sharon, when he was in other positions in the government before he became prime minister, is one of the people who helped start the whole effort to build these outposts. But again, one of the theories here in Israel, and one of the things that was written about in the morning newspaper columns rather extensively, was that Sharon did this because he knew he would get criticism from primarily the U.S., and he's doing it as a way to quiet the extreme right wing, which is very critical of his disengagement plan, his plan to draw the settlements and the Israeli soldiers out of Gaza. And this report can become a fallback when he has to adhere to the provisions of the roadmap and he has to pay some attention to what the U.S. is saying.
Now that all of this is a matter of public record in a report commissioned by the Prime Minister himself, and to quote the report, blatant violations of law are laid out there, will there be a crackdown? Does even Prime Minister Sharon have the political and logistical wherewithal to turn these outposts around, to shut them down, to put an end to the expansion?
Well, this is the big question, of course. Sharon has been promising ever since the roadmap was created a little over 2 years ago that he was going to take down outposts. Israel has made a really half-hearted effort to do it, has taken down a handful, and most of those have in fact sprouted up a few hundred yards away from the original place. These, of course, are very, very emotional issues, and even the attempts to pull away two or three illegal mobile trailer homes is usually met with hundreds and hundreds of angry, emotional settlers who curl insults and push and shove with the Israeli soldiers who are trying to remove the trailers.
Molly, everybody seems to agree these days that broader peace in the region, maybe even globally, is not possible without peace right there between the Israelis and Palestinians. Is peace possible if these outposts and settlements continue to go on, continue to expand?
As far as Palestinians are concerned, peace is not possible if they continue to expand, because what's at stake here is this expansion is eating away land that would and property of the Palestinians that would be part of any independent Palestinian state, which both Ariel Sharon and U.S. President George Bush have endorsed. You know, the best description of what's happening here, if you take the West Bank and if you look at it now, and if you were to paint in where settlements and outposts and settlement expansions are going on, it makes the West Bank look like a huge chunk of Swiss cheese as opposed to the possibility for a contiguous state.
That Swiss cheese map, not the map Palestinians want to inherit as an eventual state.
It's not, because what it does and what some of the larger plans for these settlement expansions and the use of these outposts is in fact to cut off sections of the West Bank. And if you look at the maps and the plans that are on the books to expand these settlements illegally, the plans very clearly show efforts to use settlements and outposts and special bypasses and roads to actually cut off parts of the West Bank from each other. And, of course, this would make a very difficult state for the Palestinians to govern, a very difficult state in which to control security, and a state which would be economically hamstrung.
Molly, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for being with us tonight.
You're quite welcome.
Molly Moore is Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post. She spoke with us from Jerusalem. We are talking tonight about Israel's internal struggle over West Bank land and peace. You can join the conversation. What do you make of new evidence that the Israeli government, has supported the expansion of Jewish outposts across the West Bank in violation of Israeli law? What does it mean for Israel, for Washington, for Middle East peace? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Ehud Eran, Israeli lawyer, former assistant foreign policy advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and senior research fellow at the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School. Ehud Eran, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So, big response to this report in Israel, even though it's been described as kind of open secret. Why has this landed with such a force?
I think there are two main reasons for this significance. One is that the government is for the first time open about it in great detail. It's a 300-page report with aerial photography, etc. Secondly, the fact that it was initiated by Prime Minister Sharon, the former champion of the settlement movement, signifies perhaps the dramatic change he himself went through.
And what's the core conflict that's revealed here? Not between Israelis and Palestinians. There's plenty to talk about there. Palestinians have their own issues. We've talked about them a lot. But the conflict within the Israeli polity here.
Israel is deeply divided over the question of what to do with the territories it acquired in the 1967 war. This division has been going on since 1967. And the question is, should we keep this West Bank and the Gaza Strip or hand them as a part of a peace agreement? So on one level, this is a debate about Israel's future borders. But on a deeper level, there's a debate about the nature of the Israeli state. Expanding Israel would mean including millions of Palestinians, which will then force Israel to decide, does it want to be a democracy or does it want to be a Jewish state?
How serious is this split? I mean, it's gone on for a long time, but now the pressures appear to be growing. Is this, I mean, we saw an assassination of an Israeli prime minister not so many years ago. Is this a conflict with the potential to really split Israel in even a violent way?
Yeah, there's definitely potential for violence. The two political assassinations of the 80s and the 90s, Prime Minister Rabin, and before that in the early 80s, a Peace Now activist called Emil Greenzweig was over the question of the settlements. Moreover, now that the settler community is bigger and has more access to resources, there's greater potential to violence. Absolutely.
But are we coming closer to it? Do you see the pressure being put on from Washington, the pressure by events in the Middle East, as raising the temperature? Sharon has promised to get out of Gaza.
Yeah, the main reason of the pressure is what you mentioned, Sharon's plan. In a few months' time, Sharon is planning to relocate 8,000 settlers. For the first time in Israeli history. So these people feel that they are with their back to the wall. Their life's project is about to be dismantled. So we are definitely getting to a pressure point.
Ehud Iran, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about a new Israeli report on illegal Israeli West Bank settlement. It's shaking up the Middle East, Washington, and the peace process. You can join us tonight. What does it mean that Israel's government has been secretly supporting the West Bank outposts it claims to oppose? And is this the hole in Israel's approach to peacemaking, the equivalent of the Palestinian who will not recognize Israel? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new Israeli report on illegal Israeli West Bank settlement and the struggle between peace and the idea of greater Israel. You can join the conversation tonight. Is peace possible if Israel cannot resolve its own internal struggle over the West Bank and Gaza? And how should Washington respond to this official confirmation of an open secret? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Ehud Iran. He is a senior research fellow at the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School and a former foreign policy advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. And now from Westchester, New York, by Mark Rosenblum, founder and policy director of Americans for Peace Now. Mark Rosenblum, thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Your group in Israel and in the States, Peace Now, has followed this issue for many years. Do you feel affirmed by this big report coming out this week?
Well, there is a sense of a confirmation of what everyone has known as an open secret, and some ministers and some government officials have acknowledged that this is a sore in Israel. But I think what is really most important from our perspective is that the Sassoon Commission and her report, the part that so far has been revealed, I think is the equivalent of an Israeli SOS. And what I mean by this call for urgency, this SOS, is I think it stands for sovereignty over settlements. And the sovereignty I'm speaking about that's in question here is not Palestinian sovereignty, but it's first and foremost the sovereignty of the Jewish Democratic State of Israel. I think the most troubling and yet important development is that this is a clarion call, an urgent call, for Israel to choose whether it's going to allow a state within a state, will allow the settlement movement. And I think the issue is not just the 54 illegal outposts that are identified here, illegal according to the Israeli internal process of establishing settlements, but the broader settlement enterprise, because I think in general, from my point of view and the movement of Peace Now's point of view, the settlements have had a very corroding impact. A small minority of Jewish settlers, and I want to be clear about this, of the 230,000 odd Jewish settlers in the West Bank and Gaza, the majority of them are not fanatics, they're not violent. They've gone and been subsidized to go to the West Bank and Gaza. They live in hilltop communities with easy access to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And these are people that are potentially brought back by way of a fair compensation package. But there is a minority that has control over some of the most important institutions of the West Bank and Gaza that are violent, and the hilltop youth in particular that characterize these settlement outposts in particular are problematic. And Israel is now confronting the fact, the harsh reality, there's either going to be a state with laws and elected officials who will make decisions that will be respected, or there will be a small group of people that will try and hijack the state and march to a higher drummer.
I'm looking here at a fresh report out of Israel today saying that Talia Sasson, who brought out the former chief prosecutor who brought out this big report, is saying that democracy itself is at risk in Israel if the law can be so widely flouted. Mark Rosenblum, is the crisis that deep?
I think it is. I think that Israel still is a robust, singular democracy in the Middle East, but its policies and its actions in the West Bank and Gaza, in the territories, the occupied territories, have created a situation that has corroded again the larger democracy. And Israel has to find a way, and I think this is what Sharon is courageously, slowly coming to grips with. He is choosing demography, a Jewish majority, over geography, which is the greater Israel. And the settlers, particularly the most militant among them, in the illegal outposts and those also in the other legal settlements established according to Israeli law, do not honor the Israeli decision-making democratic process. This is a moment of truth, and I think this is a challenge and a good day to see the nature of the challenge.
Ehud Eran, how do you interpret Ariel Sharon's action here? He commissioned this study. He had to know what it was going to say, presumably. Mark Rosenblum says it's a mark of his courage here. Of course, you know, there are many skeptics out there as well saying, no, he wants to end up with the settlements that he's long been a champion of. What's your interpretation of what's going on?
Yeah, maybe because I grew up in Israel with a different Sharon, I'm still suspicious of his long-term goals. And I think the best explanation is the explanation given by his chief of staff, Dubi Weissglass, in an interview to Haaretz, in which he described the Gaza pullout as something that will freeze the next phases and will push away any pressure on Israel to withdraw from the West Bank. Still, I think that it is significant that Israel is leaving Gaza in that respect. The precedent could serve even another administration and is therefore important.
So, I wanted to make it clear what I'm suggesting is not necessarily that Sharon is facing completely up to the entire problem of this SOS of settlements or Israeli sovereignty. I think that there's a broader issue of settlements, and there is the suspicion that he does intend to focus on the outposts as a way of taking heat off of the more broad question of other Jewish settlements in the West Bank, particularly those that are poised to prevent the negotiating of a territorially contiguous and viable Palestinian state. So I'm not suggesting here that the evidence is all in, that Sharon is willing to confront the broader issues of democracy and sovereignty and face what the settlements have done in general in corroding Israeli democracy. And by the way, the settlements issue are a tremendous risk to Israeli security, and I'm not just talking about the outposts. If you look at the settlements that exist in the West Bank, the legal ones, not just the outposts, it stretches Israel's security parameters some tenfold. That means Israeli soldiers have to be devoted to protecting those settlements, and it makes it much more difficult to protect Israel proper.
Mark Rosenblum, Ehud Eran, please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome to our conversation from Washington, Martin Indyk. He's director of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Was ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Israel, 95 to 97. In 2000 to 2001, he served as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs from 1997 to 2000. Martin Indyk, thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Good evening.
Good evening. You have no doubt seen reports on this report. The full text, of course, still to come, but everybody's got the idea. Martin Indyk, how do you see what's revealed here, the open secret that's now officially on the table, is factoring in to the peace process and in particular, to Washington's relationship with the Sharon government?
Well, the whole report came out of that relationship between Prime Minister Sharon and President Bush. Sharon, under the roadmap arrangements, promised to evacuate these illegal outposts. He promised Bush to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And what then started was a process of trying to identify which were illegal and which were legal, and then to try to evacuate them. And the government discovered in the process of evacuating them that others were being built at the same time, and the whole thing became somewhat of a farce and an embarrassment. President Bush made it very clear to Prime Minister Sharon that he expected him to live up to his commitment. And basically, Sharon said, I can't, because, first of all, we've got to get control of this, find out what exactly is going on here. And so that's what generated, as I understand it, the report. And now Sharon has made it clear that he's going to act on it. He's taken to the cabinet on Sunday, and he will act on it. Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, has made it clear to the Israeli Foreign Minister yesterday in Washington that the President fully expected the Prime Minister to live up to his commitment to evacuate all of these settlements. So the report itself is very significant in terms of ending the delay of sending this to a committee, as it were, and forcing the Prime Minister's hand. He now has to act on the report, and it looks as if he is, in fact, going to do so.
Do you believe that even a tough Prime Minister like Ariel Sharon, with his history of supporting settlers, and therefore no small goodwill there, does he have the power, the clout, the will to make this happen? The opposition to it happening is very fierce.
Well, let's distinguish two things. One is evacuating all of the settlements from Gaza and from the northern West Bank as part of the unilateral disengagement plan. That's what he's fighting settlers over, and the opposition to that is very fierce and very nasty and life-threatening. The illegal outposts are illegal, and Sharon has a much stronger position there, and I think the settlers will no doubt fight him, because these are the people who are in these illegal outposts are fanatics who don't believe in the rule of law. But he'll have the strong backing of the Israeli popular opinion for that. I don't think he's going to have a problem evacuating the outposts. It's the way in which that issue combines with the evacuation of the settlements in Gaza that creates a kind of deeper psychological problem for the settlers and the deep anger in them, and so, you know, I think he would like to be able to separate the two and just deal with the evacuation of Gaza, but the timing, he's not going to be able to do that, and I think that what we'll see is he'll move on the illegal settlements quite quickly before he evacuates the ones from Gaza.
So overall, I hear you saying, Martin Indyk, that this very public exposure of the outpost issue, a step toward being able to move toward negotiation, toward peace, hopefully.
Well, yes. I mean, I think to understand what Sharon is doing here politically is he's basically setting up the situation where it becomes possible for him to move against these illegal outposts by having this report, by showing the way in which these were set up against the law, how money was taken from the government coffers, from the public purse, illegally for these purposes, that Palestinian land was taken illegally to build these things. He creates a public environment with the pressure from the United States that will enable him to do these things. Once he does them, I think it will be help to build confidence on the Palestinian side that the whole settlement enterprise, which they find so threatening to their pursuit of their rights, that something is going to be changing here.
Martin Indyk at the Brookings Institution, former U.S. ambassador to Israel, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
I want to turn now for another perspective to New York and Helen Friedman. She's executive director of Americans for a Safe Israel. It's a 30-year-old organization that supports the Israeli presence in the West Bank and Gaza and settlers there. Helen Friedman, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome. I'm delighted to be with you, and I can see that I am the still, small, silent voice in the wilderness in this group that you've gathered tonight, because indeed I take exception to almost everything that I've been listening to here.
Please give us your perspective. How do you see the settlements, in particular the outposts, big headlines in Israel today?
I don't call them outposts. I don't call them settlements. You know, this is part of Israel as far as I'm concerned. The people who talk about illegal outposts and talk about taking PA land illegally are just disregarding history entirely. How can we just forget about all the victories that Israel had in the various wars that were conducted against it by the Arab nations? How can we forget about the Palestine mandate that granted to Britain at the San Remo Conference in 1920 that it was given as a Jewish national home? How can we forget that that was an area of land that included Transjordan, which is now today Jordan, was a huge piece of land. And then in 1920, 21, all of that eastern part of the Jordan, over the Jordan, was given away to the Arabs. And Israel was left with about less than a third of the original mandate.
Helen Friedman, how do you gauge the depth of determination on the part of people in America like yourself and in Israel living in these outposts, the depth of their determination to stay in these positions, whatever Ariel Sharon may say?
The depth of determination is so deep that I am convinced, I know that they are going to win because they have everything on their side. They have the biblical entitlement on their side. Why do we ignore the biblical entitlement? Why do we ignore history? Why do we ignore moral entitlement? Why do we allow people like Martin Rosenblum and Martin Indyk and thousands more to talk about illegality and incitement and...
Well, there is an Israeli constitution and Israeli law. Doesn't that make it an issue?
Have you taken a look at what is called the Palestinian National Covenant? Do you know what it says?
I know there's another side to this, and we've talked a lot about it. Tonight we're just looking at this internal struggle that Israelis are having, and it's fascinating. How do you see, Helen Friedman, the prospects for peace, given your perspective that Israelis should stay there? Is peace ever possible in that scenario, or is that not an issue for you?
Peace may be possible, but not with people who have never changed their mandate and their goal to destroy the Jewish nation. The Palestinian National Covenant absolutely is filled with clause after clause declaring that Israel can't exist. Now, this was supposed to have been changed a number of times. There were all kinds of requirements. 1996, it was supposed to have been changed. It never happened. 1997, it was supposed to be changed. It never happened.
And you're still...
peace with people whose dedicated goal is to destroy you.
Some people. And you're still waiting, and we hear that loud and clear. Mark Rosenblum, how do you respond to this perspective?
Well, the small little problem that she didn't address when you asked her what about Israeli laws is she turned to talk about the grievances, legitimate and real, she has against Palestinians, as if Israel should aspire to parallel the worst elements that have befuddled Palestinian society. Israel is a democracy, and this is a profound question. And the second response to her would focus on the issue that Sharon has increasingly talked about and which members of his party are increasingly focusing on, and that's the issue of how to remain a democratic and Jewish state with territorial aspirations that she defined them would have actually taken Israel not just to the West Bank but to the other side, to Jordan as well. You'll never maintain a Jewish and democratic state with a minority of Jews living on that territory. So there is a fundamental choice here of democracy.
Let me remind you that Hitler was elected in a democratic process, and there have been many, many, and in Iran, the mullahs came in on democratic processes. Democracy is wonderful when it's practiced as it is here in America. there are other ways of practicing democracy so that the results are not what you're looking for.
Are you talking about Israel?
I'm saying that it's undemocratic for Prime Minister Sharon to take the mandate that he got from the people when he was elected prime minister overwhelmingly in opposition to the Mitzna labor platform, which would be to create a Palestinian state and to give away territory. He was elected in opposition to that plan, and he has done a total reversal of position. He's now giving away all of this.
Helen Friedman, let me ask you, do you have any fear that the position you take here, or this conflict we're looking at tonight, may actually end up splitting the Israel that you clearly want to defend?
It is split. It is split. Why are you pretending that it's not?
No, I mean splitting it in a way that does real damage to Israel.
Likud had a referendum within its own party about this disengagement, this expulsion, this Judenrein situation that's being created. They had a referendum which Sharon lost. He disregarded it. When he had Uzi Landau in opposition to him, he dismissed him. FBA Tom, who was in opposition to him, he dismissed him.
And there's the split, and it's big, and it's real. Helen Friedman, thank you very much for joining us tonight from New York. Helen Friedman, Executive Director of Americans for a Safe Israel. We're looking at the new report on illegal Israeli West Bank settlement. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new Israeli report on illegal Israeli West Bank settlement outposts and the struggle, you're hearing it tonight, between the kind of peace push and the push, very deeply held push and belief for greater Israel in some quarters. You can join the conversation tonight. Is Israel genuinely open to peace in good faith if its government is breaking its own laws to expand West Bank settlement outposts? And settlement supporters, make your case. Is this divinely ordained? Do you simply not believe in a Palestinian state? Does Israeli security demand a network of settlements and outposts? And for everybody, will Israel work this out or tear itself apart over settlements? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Ehud Eran, former foreign policy advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and Mark Rosenblum, founder and policy director of Americans for Peace. Now, we're joined right now from Newton, Massachusetts, by Jeffrey. Jeffrey, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you for a great show. I wanted two things quickly to say about what Helen was talking about.
This is Jeffrey Lewis.
Yes.
Oh, good to have you. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Thanks, Tom. First of all, there was a government commission that called the outposts illegal. I mean, it's not Mark Rosenblum or anybody else. It's a government commission, as I understand it.
Very clearly.
And the overwhelming majority of Israelis, I think, are opposed to such illegal outposts. And I think that I think that Helen tries to paint a picture that I don't think is accurate. I think the overwhelming majority of Israelis are law-abiding, they believe in the rule of law, and they will support the illegal outposts being dismantled. Mark's very humble. You should know that that Peace Now is really the key organization in terms of monitoring this activity, and they are both the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority rely on what they do in terms of dealing with
that is monitoring the outposts, counting the outposts, and the progress of these trailers that show up.
Right, and also the settlement activity. Really, they are really the key people in terms of monitoring that activity. But I want to talk about something hopeful, because I think we need to look at this in another way as well, and that is that, remember, this is an Israeli government commission. So kudos to the Israeli government for even having this commission, knowing full well that it might come out the way that it did. Secondly, let's remember that there's a new housing minister now, Isaac Herzog, who went into the office and, as I understand it, froze all funding for settlements until this all got cleared up. So I believe that given this particular minister, given the government's, for whatever reason, their willingness to look at what's happening here, and given that the majority of Israelis are clearly people who believe in the rule of law, I think we can look forward to not a time without difficulty, but a time where this will move forward in a very positive way.
But let me ask you, Jeffrey, what about that minority? We see the majority and where it stands, it's clear in all the polls, but the minority, and you heard it in Helen Friedman's voice here, the determination, we see it in the video that comes out from these fights that break out whenever an outpost is removed. What about the depth of that determination? How does Israel handle that?
I think they handled it by doing what they've done in the past. And if you remember, when the Israelis withdrew from Sinai, there were similar kinds of incidents. Again, it's a minority, and the vast majority of Israelis will support troops going in there and doing whatever they need to do to dismantle those outposts in the same way that they will support what the government does with respect to the disengagement from Gaza and the northern West Bank. I think that we can be very hopeful about that, because I do believe that Israel is ultimately very much a society that is governed by and believes in the rule of law.
Jeffrey Lewis, thanks very much for calling in tonight. Good to hear from you. Ehud Iran, do you agree? Will this ultimately be effectively handled? Will the weight of the majority of Israelis be decisive in leaving a situation that Palestinians, Israelis, and everybody else can live with here?
I tend to agree that it will be possible, and not only because the government is determined.
You say you don't agree, or you do?
No, I do agree that it is possible. Yeah, I'm sorry. And that's part of this project I'm involved with Professor Manukin at Harvard Law School. We have been engaging with settler leaders in the last 2 years, and I'm much more optimistic after these 2 years of discussions. Majority of the settler leaders, including what we call the extremists, are committed to the state of Israel and are against violence. And we are really talking about a fringe of a fringe. So even within the settler community, there are positive voices.
Mark Rosenblum, are you equally optimistic?
Yes, I think that I think we're on the road to a potential secure deoccupation process, and I think the Gaza and northern part of the West Bank is something that certainly isn't within reach, but we shouldn't kid ourselves. It depends on the dynamic of getting out of Gaza and the northern part of the West Bank, and then the real issue will be whether there really is a partner that has the will and the capacity on the Palestinian side mm-hmm. to rein in violence, and whether there can be a negotiating process on the really nuclear issue, so to speak, including the remainder of the settlements that prevent a territorially contiguous state in Jerusalem and refugees. These are issues that are not uphill, they're up mountain, but I think there's a process underway that gives us a great deal of hope.
Lots of hurdles, but a beginning, and maybe more of a beginning, with the openness of this report. Andy is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Andy, you're on the air.
Hi, Herb. I'm not as I hope that the things can happen that your speakers are talking about. I'm not Jewish, and I'm not Arabic, and I really don't have any axe to grind in any of this myself personally.
Okay.
But in talking to a fair number of different people, experts, and reading the New York Times and watching CNN a lot,
yep.
I agree with what most of whom I would consider the most objective experts say that I've heard in the last 6 months or a year, that the only way that there's really going to be substantial and lasting change there is if the United States especially, and to some degree the leading European countries, most influential European countries, take a more proactive involvement in the situation.
You're essentially talking about pressure on the Palestinians, pressure on the Israelis.
Well, I don't necessarily mean pressure alone, but
pressure, support.
Yeah, more positive involvement in it. I think that one thing that I'm really against is the fact that the America seems to still favor Israel over the Palestinians in most of their rhetoric anyway, and that doesn't do any good.
But the issue you raise is what kind of outside role may be required to get past this great number of hurdles here. Andy, thanks for calling in with that. Ehud Iran, we have talked on this show with Sharon government people, with Palestinian folks. We've talked a lot about the hurdles Palestinians have to keep their militant edge in line and give peace a chance here. What about the role of outside powers, of Washington, of Europe? How important is it? Can Israel work this out on its own? It's internal conflict that we're talking about tonight.
I think there is a role for external actors, but we also have to be realistic about it. It seems to me that debate about the settlements is debate about Israel's identity. And in identity debates, there's a limited role to external power or pressure. The same, by the way, goes mm-hmm. In the Palestinian camp. They are debating over the right of return. It's a question about their narrative. And there's only so much to what an external actor can do in that respect.
So it's got to happen internally.
In my view, absolutely. And I happen to agree with...
But we've waited so long. I mean, for everybody here, you're saying you see some optimism here. Let's get one more call. Mark is calling from New York City. Mark is on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi. My thoughts were that as a whole, the settlement enterprise was a good strategic idea because it gave consequences for aggressive behavior on behalf of the Arab nation.
Negotiate or lose land.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I think by bringing in Helen Friedman as the other voice, it was really a disservice to the split in Israeli society. She's a real fanatic. Most people would agree to territorial compromise and a final status, but oppose the naive and dangerous visions of peace now, which produced Oslo, and ignored the rhetoric and the unreadiness of Palestinian society to accept a solution on the right of return.
Mark, your phone line is a little rough, but I hear you saying that there's a kind of moderate line between what we've the voices that we've heard tonight, and we thank you for that observation. Mark Rosenblum, you're called naive and dangerous there. Do you think peace now is coming closer to Israeli mainstream thought today, or has it always been there?
I think the overall agenda of peace now, negotiating a two-state solution, security for Israel and a territorial contiguous state for the Palestinians, and a fair and comprehensive solution with compromises, both from the Palestinian and Israeli side, is today a very mainstream position. I think, in a word, what's happened is that the overall ideas of the Machiavellian doves that founded peace now, the Reserve Army officers, have carried the day, but they don't have leaders that are electable. We have Sharon implementing policies based on the rhetoric he's now endorsed of a Palestinian state, of an occupation, he's used the O word, and now he's talking about evacuating settlements. So I think the mainstream and the liberal dovish tendency in Israel and their ideas have won, but they are being championed now by a very unlikely person who has a biography hardly of a centrist dove.
So Ariel Sharon, nothing like a founder of peace now, but there he is in charge. He asked for the report. He got it. It's tough. It's on the record. Mark Rosenblum, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Mark Rosenblum is founder and policy director of Americans for Peace Now and Ehud Eran. Thank you so much for being with us in the studio this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Ehud Eran, a former advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and now senior research fellow at the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a reporter takes us to the road where American soldiers fired on an Italian journalist late last week. This is On Point. Fallout continues over the shootings by American soldiers that left Italian journalist Giuliana Segrena wounded and an Italian intelligence officer dead in Baghdad last week. Today, Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi publicly disputed the U.S. version of the events that led to the shooting. Quoting him, "It feels like an injustice beyond any sentiment," he said in his first public address since the shooting. "It's something unreasonable." President Bush has promised a full investigation of the incident, which unfolded on the road leading to the Baghdad airport. Los Angeles Times reporter Alyssa Rubin knows the road where the shooting occurred well. In fact, she had traveled it just 5 hours before Segrena last Friday. She says the road is a favorite target zone for militants and a nightmare for anyone who has to travel it. In this radio diary, she describes the airport road and says the chaos there could help explain how the shootings could have happened.
The route runs through a broad and flat landscape, bare but for a few date palms rising tall and dignified, and the occasional small bush. Goats mill about, shepherded by young boys or old men. Except for the litter of plastic bottles and bags, the scene is almost pastoral, peaceful. It hardly seems the place where people could hide and detonate bombs or jump out and ambush vehicles. But this is Baghdad's airport road, 7 miles of dread. It was on this road that U.S. soldiers opened fire Friday night on the car carrying Italian journalist Giuliana Segrena. Having reported from Iraq for much of the last 2 years, I was dismayed to hear that a fellow journalist who had survived the unimaginable stress and fear of being a hostage was then the victim of an American military shooting. But when I learned the incident occurred on the airport road, it became, at one level, understandable. Bad things happen on the road all the time. Many people who travel it on a regular basis have a personal horror story, a moment when they thought this might be it. Since the war, the airport road has not been any ordinary highway. It's a battleground, a place without rules or certainties, a place where there are no guarantees of safety for anyone. For the ordinary traveler, there are two hazards: the wary, short-fused American troops who have lost dozens of their comrades to roadside bombs and ambushes, and the insurgents who target the U.S. military convoys that ply the route. About 5 hours before Segrena was shot, I was on the same road, traveling in the opposite direction from the airport into Baghdad, with what has become routine unease. Rather than looking at the scenery, I stared straight ahead and felt a faint nausea. I travel in an old Iraqi car and dress in a black gown and headscarf so as not to attract attention. When a military convoy appears, my driver slows to a crawl and waits for it to get at least a half a mile ahead before picking up pace again. We fear we might get hit if we get too close and insurgents open fire on the convoy. As the road slipped by on Friday, I was struck by the calm of the scene and yet aware of my suspicions. Were the three children playing in the scrub by the side of the road just in need of a playground, or had they been trained to step on a detonator as a U.S. convoy moved by? Was the dead goat stuffed with explosives? Could the quiet neighborhood with hardly a car in sight be hiding insurgents? See, that's where there was an IED, my driver Ahmed said, using the military's shorthand for improvised explosive device. You can see the pit, he said, gesturing to a crater. On this route, it's hard to know whether a car that speeds by a military convoy simply has a nervous driver or carries a suicide bomber. Last fall, a bomber on the road targeted an armored bus carrying U.S. personnel. One of the mosques near the beginning of the route, Ibn Tamiya, is well known as an insurgent center. When U.S. soldiers searched it, they found grenades, ammunition, and guns. The Americans have tried to make it difficult for insurgents to operate along the road. They've chopped down palm trees and taken down fences that the rebels hide behind. They have put up observation cameras. They have handed out leaflets and warned people who live in the area not to collaborate with insurgents, but the insurgents keep finding new ways to attack. On Friday, a military convoy sped by. We stopped, letting it go far ahead. Next, we sighted two SUVs that looked like they might be carrying security contractors. Again, we slowed for fear that insurgents might target them. Suddenly, Ahmed sped up, barreling down the rough highway at nearly 80 miles per hour. My worries about insurgents and skittish U.S. soldiers quickly turned to fears of an accident as he honked to get cars to move out of the way. He believed we were being followed. A burgundy car with three men in it was visible in our rearview mirror, speeding close behind us. We couldn't tell if they were armed. Finally, we lost them and slowed down. As we drew up to our hotel, we saw the car again. It had been the chase car of another news organization. The misplaced suspicion would have been funny if the situation had not been so dangerous. The Italians were on the road at a far worse time. Although there are few attacks at night, there is also little visibility, and the U.S. military suspects every vehicle. Like us, Segrena must have been frightened of being on the road. But having just escaped from insurgents, she probably never would have thought she would be mistaken for one of them.
Alyssa Rubin, co-chief of the Baghdad Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.